Yeah, but don't do it yet. Well, that's all right. 2 Samuel chapter 3 is where we're at. Saul is dead. David should be, at this point, the rightful heir to the throne. Immediately, the people in the south, the southern kingdom, also known as Judah, has actually already crowned him king, has already anointed him. And now we're just waiting because in the north, the commander of the army, whose name was Abner, who was the son of Ner, but also Abner means father of Ner. So he's Ner, the father of Ner and the son of Ner. And so we got Abner, and he's the commander of the army in the north, and he decides to not follow David at this point in time, and instead sets up his own king, a long-lost son of Saul that we don't even know where he came from. Bonus points if you remember his name. Man of shame in the English translation. In the Hebrew, we would pronounce it Ishbosheth. But yes, man of shame. He was a shameful man. And he is the king that was set up. And then we had that strange little battle where, you know, 12 guys on one side, 12 guys on the other, and they all rush forward and stab each other, and they all fall over dead. Essentially communicating the concept that these armies were really well matched. But verse 1 of chapter 3, the war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. And we're going to see how that plays out because eventually the northern kingdom falls to David or essentially starts backing him simply because of probably some really misplaced words. Verse 2, sons were born to David in Hebron. This list cracks me up. As one pastor said, how do you pronounce some of these names in the Old Testament? And the answer, very carefully. All right, here we go. Sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon, the son of Ahinom of Jezreel. His second, Kileab, the son of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. The third, Absalom, the son of Maacah, daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. She had a lisp. The fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital, and the sixth, Ithream, the son of David's wife, Eglah, which is a really cool name. These were born to David in Hebron. Now, do you notice anything interesting about that list? They all sound like men, which is really creepy, I agree. Six kids born to six different wives. Well, this could be a problem, don't you think? Right, as we've said all along, you can note this in your Bibles if you want. Deuteronomy 17:17 makes it very clear. God says, do not multiply wives lest they lead you astray. And David has six, and by the end of the chapter, he will have number seven. Good gravy. We're not going to get into each one of these kids and what they did because eventually we will going through the course of 2 Samuel. I'll say this. David is a man after God's own heart, very passionate in his worship, very dedicated in his worship of God and his faithfulness and obedience to God, but had to be near the top five worst fathers of the Bible. So that should tell you something, that you can be a great worshiper, you could be a great tender of church. You could be a great someone that in your heart you sing worship and praise to God. That does not necessarily translate one-to-one that you're going to be a great parent. Having great parenting skills is different than having great worship skills. And much like we often have to learn how to worship and grow in our worship, you should also learn how to be a good parent and how to do that correctly. David is horrible, and partially it gets later on after we hit chapter 11. We're on a climb. We're on the uphill climb of David. David is ascending and doing some fantastic stuff. He's a bonehead and does some weird things here and there. I'll grant that. But we hit chapter 11, and it's from there. It is straight downhill. You can probably guess what happened in chapter 11. Old David and Bathsheba incident, right? That's when, boom, it starts going south. And then all of a sudden, his kids start going wild and out of control, and David doesn't do squat one. It's very interesting. So there's a lesson for us in there that just because you are a fantastic worshiper does not translate into being a good parent. learning how to be a good parent is very, very important. And David, dare I say, probably should have taken a couple of lessons. But anyway, he's got these six wives, six kids, and it causes problems later on. Verse 6. During the war between the house of Saul and the house of David, Abner had been strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. Now, what that means, we're not entirely true. We're going to get maybe a hint of what it might be, but we're not sure if even that's true. Remember, Abner is just the commander of the army. He's not the king. But you may call him, I guess, the kingmaker. He was the one that set Ishbosheth up. He was the one that rallied the people around him and said, here is your king, let's anoint him, let's follow him, and essentially rallied everyone so that they would follow him and not follow David. You know the sad part about this? Is that Abner knew from the beginning that David would ultimately become king. I mean, you can read that, we'll get there, but it's in verse 9. He actually admits that David is the one that is going to lead everything. Which leads you to ask the question, why in the world is he backing another king? Why is he strengthening his own power within that kingdom when he knows that ultimately David is where you need to go to? Well, it probably isn't as crazy as you think, because I don't know, maybe it's just my radar antenna have been up a whole lot more when you read some of the stuff. And I'm starting to see, I am getting inundated lately with people who come to me for advice on issues. And more, I'm not giving any advice because it's really easy. All I have to do is look at them and say, well, what do you think the right answer is? And boom, they tell me. And then I say, well, so what's, I don't know, what's the problem? Like, why not do it? And they always say the same, well, we're hoping there was like a loophole, like a divine thing we can get through, because I know that's what I'm supposed to do, but can I wiggle out of this in any way, shape, or form? And I just smile, and I go, well, what do you think? And of course they come back, like, well, I think that there isn't a loophole, but I don't know, you're a pastor, and you know Greek and Hebrew, so maybe can I get a... No, can't get around it. You already know the right answer. And this is the same thing with Abner. You want to pull him aside and say, you know that David's going to be the king. Why are you doing this? And I don't know. Maybe it's also because we're seeing a huge rash of youth that were youth several years ago and are now becoming or are young adults. That seems to be when a lot of those questions start taking place. Very fascinating. But anyway, okay, back to Abner. He's strengthening his own position. Now Saul, verse 7, Saul had a concubine named Rizpah. Concubines were not technically a wife. They were just there to keep the royal line alive, so to speak. Had this concubine named Rizpah, daughter of Ai, and Ishbosheth said to Abner, why did you sleep with my father's concubine? Which, of course, begs the question, did Abner sleep with his father's concubine? We have no idea. I mean, we have this strange statement that Abner is strengthening his position in the army and in the house. Is this, it very well could be true. And when you read this stuff, you start getting the idea that I think there might be some truth in this statement, but we have no idea of how to prove it. Essentially, Ishbosheth, and that was how it worked. If you wanted to make a play for the throne and you wanted to exert your power and authority, if you could get to the king's concubines and take them for yourself, you would establish yourself as the main player. It's almost like, I guess, getting endorsements nowadays in the political realm. So-and-so endorses me, so-and-so endorses me, so you all need to vote for me because so-and-so likes me more than they like this other candidate. That's how this is working. So, I don't know. I think he did. But you could disagree with me all the live long day. I think Abner did make a play for Rizpah, the concubine, and Ishbosheth, I don't know, maybe not the most eloquent of speakers. Have you ever seen those people? They don't really have a filter, and they don't know how to like say things nicely. They just come out and blurt it out. I personally love those people because I know right where I stand. Like, you could come to me and say, Mark, that was one of the worst sermons I've ever heard. And you might think, man, can I say that? That's that's kind of rude. No, I love it personally. Now, other people, you can't quite come out and be so strong and bold. You have to kind of... Ishbosheth doesn't seem to have that ability. He just comes out, and I mean, what great dinner conversation. So, why have you taken my father's concubine as your wife? Yeah. You know, great way to do that. Abner was very angry because of what Ishbosheth said. Again, you read this and ask yourself the question, doth he protesteth too much? I don't know. Just my opinion. I could be wrong. Maybe Abner's innocent, hasn't done anything, and he just gets angry because what Ishbosheth said, he said, am I a dog's head on Judah's side? What the heck does that mean? A dog wouldn't be our dogs, you know, our little cute little puppy dogs. These would be like, maybe we'd say coyotes nowadays or wolves, something like that, wolves. They were wild, rabid animals. And so what he's saying is, am I not just a dog? Am I a dog's head? Am I the alpha dog that belongs to David? Because on Judah's side, what are you, you're accusing me of this? Do you think I'm working for the other team at this point? This very day, I am loyal to the house of your father, Saul, and to his family and friends. And ask yourself the question, does he ever, does he ever deny the accusation? He never actually does. Kind of interesting. I'm loyal to the house of your father, Saul, and to his family and friends. I haven't handed you over to David, yet now you accuse me of an offense involving this woman. May God deal with Abner, be it ever so severely, if I do not do for David what the Lord promised him on oath, and transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and establish David's throne over Israel and Judah from Dan to Beersheba. And that would be from north to south, we would say from New York to L.A. So he's essentially saying, you know what? That's enough for me. I think I'm going to jump ship, and I will help establish David to become king over everyone. Ishbosheth, you kind of get the sense from Ishbosheth that he wasn't really a strong person in his convictions and what he does, because Ishbosheth did not dare to say another word to Abner because he was afraid of him. And I don't know if he was like physically afraid that maybe he would die, or just the fact that he was intimidated by him and wasn't going to say anything. Then Abner sent messengers on his behalf to say to David, whose land is it? Make an agreement with me, and I will help you bring all Israel over to you. So now we're going to start an alliance. So, hey, I got the north. If you want the north, you're going to have to work with me, but I could sway all of them to come over to your side. Good, said David. I will make an agreement with you. At first, when I read this part of the story, I kind of chuckled because it was rather pathetic, but then after reading it several times, I started thinking, man, this is just wrong. It's just wrong. I will make an agreement with you, but I demand one thing of you. Do not come into my presence unless you bring Michal, daughter of Saul, when you come to see me. Then David sent messengers to Ishbosheth. So he demands it of Abner, but then he makes a direct plea right to Ishbosheth, son of Saul, demanding, give me my wife Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for the price of 100 Philistine foreskins. Remember the story? You know, Philistines were kind of a sore in the side of the Israelites, and Saul didn't know how to get rid of them. So he said, hey, you know what? I'm going to give my most beautiful daughter, Michal, to the man who brings me some Philistine foreskins. And David does it, and he brings it to him. And so Michal gets married off to David. But then David goes on the run, remember? And Saul gets ticked and grabs Michal and says, you're no longer married to David. I'm going to give you to this guy named Paltiel, and you're going to be his wife from now on. So Michal is married now, and David is demanding her back. And you got to ask yourself the question, what does Paltiel think of this whole thing? Well, let's find out. Verse 15, so Ishbosheth gave orders and had her taken away from her husband, Paltiel, son of Laish. Her husband, however, went with her, weeping behind her all the way to Bahurim. Then Abner said to him, go back home. So we went back. What a sad, strange little story. I mean, I could do this in the movies, right? You know, I was talking to Brandon. I could film this one, right? It'll be in a car. A chariot might be cool, but you know, if we're going to modernize it, be in a car, and Michael, you know, the secret police break in, grab Michael, throw him in the back of the car, and as they're driving away, you're going to have Michael like pressed up against the back window, and of course then we've got Pilteal, and what is he doing? He's running after, and it's got to be raining because that would look really cool, as he's running in the rain and he's yelling stop, and of course at this point all the guys are laughing and all the girls are like, oh, that's so sweet. Right? Am I right on this? Yeah. Because that's when I read this and I thought, like, this is pathetic. And Heather goes, that's really sweet. Am I right, Rich? Is that what you're thinking? Oh, yeah. There we go. He's on a Vespa. He runs out and he grabs his, yeah, and it's actually purplish, but it's kind of pinkish, but he doesn't know that because he's metrosexual. And so he's hopped on there and he's going, and of course he's crying too. And you can't tell the difference between the tears and the rain. And it's just this moving scene and all the girls are like, oh, and all the guys are like, dude, get a life. What's wrong with you? She's gone. Let her go. You know? Yeah, a little Josh Groban playing in the background. And it's got to be, I'm thinking John Cusack. He's got a big radio, too, as he's running after her. Yeah. That's what I think when I see this. But, you know, then I started thinking to myself, what? We don't know. I'm making conjecture, so please forgive me. But I wonder, what is Michael thinking at this point? Now, we know at the beginning, if you go backwards, Michael thought that David was hot. And Michael loved David and made it very well known. And even the king, Saul, at that time was like, I don't think I like this. My daughter likes this punk kid who everyone says he's going to be king over me. This isn't good. So we don't know where Michael... And did Michael care? I mean, I don't know. She's being taken. Is she thinking to herself, wow, I get a palace? I get, you know, great life? I get six other women to talk to, you know, on a daily basis. You know, I don't know how she's feeling. Of course, some people, and I'll tip my hand now so that you can be angry at me today and then when we hit David and Bathsheba. Because every time David and Bathsheba's story comes up, I seriously do have a problem with Bathsheba. I'm not joking. Now, I'm not blaming Bathsheba. Please, don't get me wrong. But when the king sent for Bathsheba, did you notice that Bathsheba went? And of course, then everyone yells at me. They're like, she had to go. It was by order of the king. And you know, it's kind of the same thing with Michael. She had to go. And I go, I don't know, really? Yeah, and then I think at that point, are we willing to die? I mean, I think we talk about it. I mean, it's kind of the romantic religious thing to think of is I would die for my belief, especially after Columbine and Cassie... Bernal, you know, what happens if Michael said, no, I'm not going to go? And they're like, if you don't go, I kill you. What would we advise? Who knows? I think the same thing with Bathsheba. The king sent for you. No. If you don't, you die. Well, I guess, are we willing? I don't know. That's my stance on it. You may hate me, and that's fine. But I wonder if we're able to stand up. But we don't know about Mike. But you know who I'm really ticked at? And I'm really honest about this. I'm really upset with David. Why does he want Michael? Because that was Saul's daughter. You get Michael. Yeah. Yeah, it's a trophy. I got the daughter of the king. And she's rightfully mine. But you start thinking to yourself, at what cost? Yeah. Yeah, dude, I took out 100 Philistines, maybe a few more to get everything. But look at me, look how great. And also, does he even say? I mean, it would be one thing if he goes, you know what? My heart really, truly does belong to only one woman, and that's Michael. But he doesn't. He's like, no. I paid for her. I bought her. She's mine. And I start thinking to myself, dang it, David, what the heck? Why are you doing this when there is obviously someone who truly cares about and loves this woman and is chasing after her in the rain on a Vespa? It's my opinion. I don't like David right now for this stunt, for this move. But that's how people are. That's how life is sometimes. I don't know how many times I've met homewreckers. because they don't really care about marriage. They care about themselves. They'll do whatever because it's good for them. But they're not even thinking to themselves, what are my actions going to really seriously do to other people? I think David's a punk. That's the title of this sermon. David is a punk. So Abner and Ishbosheth essentially cave in and say, all right, David, you win. Here's Michael. Verse 17, Abner conferred with the elders of Israel and said, for some time you wanted to make David your king, now do it. Which again, that's interesting. We didn't know that piece of information up until now. It seemed like Israel wanted Ishbosheth, but the only reason why they wanted Ishbosheth was because Abner was in charge. And Abner was like, no, we're going after Ishbosheth. But apparently they had actually secretly wanted to go and follow David. So verse 18, now do it, for the Lord promised David, by my servant David I will rescue my people from Israel, from the hand of the Philistines, and from the hand of all their enemies. Abner also spoke to the Benjamites. Remember them, the Benjamites came to Abner's aid in the little skirmish that took place between Abner and Joab. Then he went to Hebron to tell David everything that Israel and the whole house of Benjamin wanted to do. When Abner, who had 20 men with him, came to David at Hebron, David prepared a feast for him and his men. Then Abner said to David, let me go at once and assemble all Israel for my lord the king, so they make a compact with you, and you may rule all that your heart desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. It kind of seems like this is normal, like a standard operating procedure. This guy can swing all these votes to me, and so I'm going to shake his hand, I'm going to throw a feast for him, and you know, we're now on good speaking terms. Now, out of curiosity, what do you think Joab's going to feel about this whole thing? Why does Joab hate Abner? Right, because Abner killed his brother. Because he wouldn't stop running after him. And that's, sometimes we forget that. And it was also not in cold blood. It was in battle. People die in battle. It wasn't anything that was malicious in that way. And he also warned him twice, that we know of, saying, hey, stop chasing after me. I don't think I can face your brother Joab. But Joab is still carrying it around. He still holds on to it. I'm sorry, we haven't even read that part. I'm telling you, we're going to read in just a moment. Joab is still going to be ticked. Joab is upset. He's holding on to everything. I don't know how many times I've said it. Holding unforgiveness in your heart only damages one person. And it's not the person that you're trying to hurt. It only hurts yourself. And that's what Joab's issue is. He needs to let it go. But he is so focused. Well, let's see how focused he is. Just then David's men and Joab returned from a raid and brought with them a great deal of plunder, but Abner was no longer with David in Hebron. Abner, he left because David had sent him away and he'd gone in peace. When Joab and all the soldiers with him arrived, he was told that Abner, son of Ner, had come to the king and that the king had sent him away and that he'd gone in peace. And so Joab went to the king and said, dude. Oh, no. Sorry. I'm sure he said dude. He was from California. What have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why did you let him go? Now he's gone. You know Abner, son of Ner. He came to deceive you and observe your movements and find out everything you are doing. He's saying, dad, why are you doing this? You should have thrown him in jail. You could have killed him, for heaven's sake, and that would have been fantastic. Joab is still really, really torqued off about this whole thing. And that is what happens in life. You get torqued off about something like that, it will stay with you. Now again, please, a reminder about forgiveness. It does not mean that Joab and Abner needed to become drinking buddies, but Joab needed to lay off this revenge mentality. Now that plagues all of us. So Joab decides to take matters into his own hands. Joab then left David and sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the well of Sarah. So Abner is heading down the road, and sends messengers to go get him, bring him back, and he comes back. But David had no idea this was going on. Now when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside into the gateway as though to speak with him privately, and there to avenge the blood of his brother Asahel, Joab stabbed him in the stomach and he died. Now, there's A lot of things wrong with that, isn't it? One is they're not in battle. They're not engaged in battle. Two is under friendly terms. So they're supposed to be a protection. Three, they're in Hebron. That actually means something. Back in those days, there were rules. Their justice system operated, and there were some certain protections. Like Bob and I were out chopping a tree together, right? And we're swinging our axes, and we're just having a good time. But Bob, he's got kind of butterfingers, right? And sure enough, shoom, the axe slips out of his hand, and it lands smack dab in my back, and I fall over dead. Well, it was an accident, right? The only problem was there was no one else. I mean, it's only Bob's story. And we all know secretly that Bob wants to take over Searchlight so that he can rule and reign over this kingdom called Searchlight. So some of you might be going, oh, no. And of course, now Heather has to take matters into her own hands. She has to avenge the blood. And so she's going to go after Melissa. Well, how did I get it dragged up? But that's how it happened. So she kills you, but then now your family is going to have to come and kill Heather. And that's just how it goes. Unless Bob is quick. Yeah. Bob has to hightail it to a special city. It's called a refuge city. And these refuge cities were very important because it was kind of a way of protecting when accidental deaths took place, so that it could stop the whole eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, life for a life deal. So Bob would run quickly to one of the refuge cities. One of them happens to be Hebron. And if Bob enters into the city of Hebron, he's like Quasimodo, you know, yelling out sanctuary. He's safe. You know, you're on safe base, right? The kids in the playground, safe. And that's what happened. Now, Bob could wander the streets, and Heather could wander the streets too, but Heather was not allowed to touch you. She was not allowed to go after you, and because you were under the protection of the priest, because the refuge cities were run by the Levites, and the Levites had a head priest. And then there would come a time when the high priest died, Bob's free. When the high priest dies, anyone living in the city of refuge who had fled because of a crime were now completely and utterly absolved, which, if you ask me, is a little cool comparing the idea that there was another high priest that died for the sins that you and I commit, sometimes on purpose, sometimes on accident. And when the high priest dies, we're free. They're in Hebron. Abner was safe, but Joab even violates that command. And he's dead. Revenge is something that is will eventually get to you. You know, I'm always reminded the whole beautiful scene in Princess Bride. You know, hello, I'm Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. And I love his things. He's like Abner, you know, or like Ishbosheth. Awkward first questions, you know. Inigo Montoya, he always goes, excuse me, do you have six fingers on your hand? Like, that's an awkward question to ask right at the beginning. If you haven't seen the movie Princess Bride, you got to watch it. It's one of the best movies. But anyway, at the end, you remember what Inigo Montoya says after he finally gets the six-fingered man? He goes, he's talking to the guy, they're about ready to jump off and go down and ride away into the sunset. And he goes, you know, I've been in the revenge business for so long, I don't know what to do with myself. Sometimes that happens. We get in the revenge business, in the revenge mode, that we don't even know how to live our life. That's how is there something that consumes you? Is there something that you're constantly obsessed with? Maybe it's time to let that go, whether it was an adult or a parent or a child that hurt you or damaged you or a friend or a coworker. Sometimes you just got to let that go, because it always ends badly. The only way it ends great is when at the end of it you go, yeah, I think I'm done doing the chase, the emotional chase to get you back. So he died, kind of a sad little ending for Abner, but Joab was going to have nothing to do with it. Later when David heard about this, he said, I and my kingdom are forever innocent before the Lord concerning the blood of Abner, son of Ner. He really had nothing to do with it, right? Right, he always operated that way. It was kind of the parallel with the death of Saul. I didn't have anything to do with Saul. Because this would be a good kill, right? I mean, strategically, politically, it would be great to kill the commander of the other army, especially since Ish-bosheth is so weak. But he's like, I didn't do it. Verse 29, may his blood fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. May Joab's house never be without someone who has a running sore or leprosy or leans on a crutch or falls by the sword who lacks food. Wow, that's a pretty strong curse. And a little footnote in case you fell asleep. Joab and his brother Abishai murdered Abner because he had killed their brother Asahel in the Battle of Gibeon. So that was last week. Verse 31, then David said to Joab and all the people with him, tear your clothes and put on sackcloth and walk in mourning in front of Abner. King David himself walked behind the bier. Then he buried Abner in Hebron, and the king wept aloud at Abner's tomb. All the people wept also. You get this idea, first and foremost, that David is kind of an emotional little dude. I think he would have been goth, personally, if he was, I don't know, I'm just guessing. He was very emotional. And he operated that way, but I never, ever get the sense that it was disingenuous. Do you? I never get the sense that he was like faking it. He truly, really was upset. The king sang this lament for Abner. Don't ask me how the tune goes, because I have no idea. Should Abner have died as the lawless die, your hands were not bound, your feet were not fettered, you fell as one who falls before wicked men. And all the people wept over him again. Then they all came and urged David to eat something while it was still day. But David took an oath, saying, may God deal with me ever so severely if I taste bread or anything else before the sun sets. All the people took note and were pleased. That's pretty huge. Not getting too personal, but when other people look at your life, are they pleased? I mean, it's just a question. I think of that question a lot. You know, when you go out and do stuff, are you living in such a way that you could stand as David did and said, look, I had nothing to do with this. I'm not participating in this evil. I'm not part and parcel of it. It's always a good question. Had to do that a little bit last night, you know, the old 20th reunion, stupid drunk people. You know, it's very fascinating. But are you able to live in such a way so that you don't cause offense? Because inevitably, it always happens. They always get to me. Oh, you married Heather. And of course, I wasn't supposed to marry Heather. She had a high school sweetheart named Ken, and through all the little pictures and everything, oh, God bless you and Ken, and you and Ken are going to make such a great couple, and you're going to get married someday. And then I came along and stole her. but eventually they get to me, and they're like, Mark, well, what do you do for a living? After I'm downing my fifth beer, would that be an appropriate time to say what I do for a living? Or maybe it'd be a little more appropriate that I haven't had the fifth beer. Yeah. So it was very interesting, and like I said, I probably shouldn't go into this, but ended up at the end getting accosted by a drunk person. That's just awkward and weird. Like, get off me. Short little lady, and she's got her hand on the back of my neck, and her husband is sitting there literally swearing the whole time. I couldn't understand a word he said, and I did this one thing like, what? And I lean in, and first of all, I almost pass out because of the fumes, and then he started. And I kind of understood a couple of words, and they were all bad and filthy. And I just thought, okay, because the music was really loud. I'm like, okay, yeah, thank you. And this woman still has her hand on my neck, and I'm like, I don't like this, and I'm very uncomfortable. Drunk people, that's weird. I think that we always need to be careful where we're at and what we do. And can we stand as David said and said, look, I had nothing to do with this, and I'm living my life in such a way so that no one could accuse me of anything? And can I live my life in such a way? You know, I also then started thinking of our own stuff. Are people pleased just because we're doing the right thing? I mean, that's a fascinating concept. When there are many times that we will do things in order to please others because we know that that's just what they want. I guess if I'm going into the political realm, I mean, wouldn't you be fascinated if we could say about the government, and I'm not just talking about this administration, I'm talking about any administration, wouldn't it be fascinating to be able to look at the government and say, and we looked at the government and we were pleased. We all chuckle. It's like, what is that even possible? Like, I don't even care who's president. I mean, can we actually say that? Because all too often, they're motivated by what? By the next polls, by the next thing. But I'm curious, how do we offer? Now, I know there's no poll on Bob. There's no poll on Louise. But I think sometimes we think there is. And do we operate in a way that we're just trying to please others? Or do we do things that are right because they're right? That's how David operated at this point in time. He's not always going to have his stuff together. So the people were pleased. Verse 37, so that on that day all the people and all Israel knew that the king had no part in the murder of Abner, son of Ner. Then the king said to his men, Do you not realize that a prince and a great man has fallen in Israel this day? And today, though I am the anointed king, I am weak. And these sons of Zeruiah are too strong for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deeds. And those are the kind of words that you want to kind of enshrine for him and bring back up when chapter 11 hits. Oh, the sons of Zeruiah, that's Joab and Asahel and whoever the third kid was that was chasing after, sorry, Zeruiah, Joab, Joab, Asahel, who died, and then whoever the third kid was. They were the sons of Zeruiah. And so what he was essentially saying was probably he was in the same boat as Ishbosheth, saying this guy Joab is getting very powerful, and he's able to take a commander of another army and kill him in cold blood, and I feel almost powerless to do anything. Yeah, the generals are running the show. And the king, he's saying, I feel really weak right now. Yeah. Which is a good position to be in because you're not in charge anyway. There's always someone more powerful than you. Let's pray. Lord God, I don't.